The Audio Partners Publishing Corporation is pleased to present Endurance, Shackleton's Incredible Voyage by Alfred Lansing, read by Tim Pigott Smith.
The story that follows is true. Every effort has been made to portray the events exactly as they occurred, and to record as accurately as possible the reactions of the men who lived them. For this purpose, a wealth of material has been generously made available to me, most notably the painstakingly detailed diaries of virtually every expedition member who kept one. These logs are a wonderfully strange assortment of documents, smudged with the smoke of blubber oil, wrinkled from being waterlogged, and then dried out. Some were written in bookkeepers' ledgers in appropriately large handwriting. Others were kept in very small notebooks in tiny script. In addition to making these diaries available to me, almost all the surviving members of the expedition submitted to long hours, even days, of interviewing, with a courtesy and cooperativeness for which my grateful appreciation is hardly an adequate repayment. The same patient willingness marked numerous letters in which these men replied to the many questions which arose. Thus, most of the survivors of this astounding adventure worked with me graciously and with a remarkable degree of objectivity to recreate as true a picture of the events as we could collectively produce. I'm extremely proud of my association with them. The order to abandon ship was given at 5 p.m. For most of the men, however, no order was needed, because by then everybody knew that the ship was done and that it was time to give up trying to save her. There was no show of fear or even apprehension. They had fought unceasingly for 3 days, and they had lost. They accepted their defeat almost apathetically. They were simply too tired to care. Frank Wilde, the second in command, made his way forward along the buckling deck to the crew's quarters. There, two seamen, Walter Howe and William Bakewell, were lying in the lower bunks. Both were very nearly exhausted from almost 3 days at the pumps, yet they were unable to sleep because of the sounds the ship was making. She was being crushed. Not all at once, but slowly, a little at a time. The pressure of 10 million tons of ice was driving in against her sides, and, dying as she was, she cried in agony. Her frames and planking screamed as the killing pressure mounted, and when her timbers could no longer stand the strain, they broke with a report like artillery fire. Most of the forecastle beams had already gone earlier in the day, and the deck was heaved upward and working slowly up and down as the pressure came and went. Wilde put his head inside the crew's quarters. He spoke quietly. "She's going, boys. I think it's time to get off." Howe and Bakewell rose from their bunks, picked up two pillowcases in which they'd stowed some personal gear, and followed Wilde back up on deck. Wilde next went down into the ship's tiny engine room. Kerr, the second engineer, was standing at the foot of the ladder. With him was Rickinson, the chief engineer. They had been below for almost 72 hours, maintaining steam in the boilers to operate the engine room pumps. Wilde did not pause long. "Let down your fires," he said. "She's going." Kerr looked relieved. Wilde turned aft to the propeller shaftway. There McNeish, the old ship's carpenter, and MacLeod, a seaman, were busy with torn pieces of blankets, caulking a cofferdam built by McNeish the day before. It had been thrown up in an attempt to stem the flow of water coming into the ship, where the rudder and the stern post had been torn out by the ice. But the water now was almost up to the floor plates, and it was gaining faster than the cofferdam could hold it back, and faster than the pumps could carry it away. Wilde signalled to the two men to give up. Then he climbed the ladder to the main deck. Clark, Hussey, James and Wordy had been at the pumps, but they had quit on their own, realising the futility of what they were doing. Now they sat on cases of stores or on the deck itself and leaned against the bulwarks. Their faces showed the unspeakable toil of the past 3 days at the pumps. Farther forward, the dog team drivers had attached a large piece of canvas to the port rail and made it into a sort of chute down to the ice alongside the ship. They took the 49 Huskies from their kennels and slid each one down to the other men waiting below. Ordinarily, any activity of this sort would have driven the dogs mad with excitement, but somehow they seemed to sense that something very extraordinary was going on. Not one fight broke out among them, and not a single dog attempted to break away. It was perhaps the attitude of the men. They worked with a deliberate urgency, hardly speaking to one another. There was no display of alarm, however. In fact, apart from the movement of the ice and the sounds from the ship, the scene was one of relative calm. The temperature was 8.5 degrees below zero, and a light southerly wind was blowing. Overhead, the twilight sky was clear. But somewhere, far away to the south, a gale was blowing towards them. Though it probably wouldn't reach their position for at least 2 days, its approach was suggested by the movement of the ice, which stretched as far as the eye could see, and for hundreds of miles beyond that. So immense was the pack, and so tight, that though the gale had not yet reached them, the distant pressure of its winds was already crushing the floes together. The whole surface of the ice was a chaos of movement. It looked like an enormous jigsaw puzzle, the pieces stretching away to infinity and being shoved and crunched together by some invisible but irresistible force. Wherever two thick floes came together, their edges butted and ground against one another for a time. Then, when neither showed signs of yielding, they rose slowly and often quiveringly, driven by the implacable power behind them. Sometimes they would stop abruptly, as the unseen force affecting the ice appeared mysteriously to lose interest. More frequently, though, the two floes, often 10 feet thick or more, would continue to rise, tenting up until one or both of them broke and toppled over, creating a pressure ridge. In this universe of ice, nowhere was the movement greater or the pressure more intense than in the floes that were attacking the ship. Nor could her position have been worse. One floe was jammed solidly against her starboard bow, and another held her on the same side aft. A third floe drove squarely in on her port beam opposite. Thus the ice was working to break her in half directly amidships. On several occasions, she bowed to starboard along her entire length. By 7 p.m., all essential gear had been transferred to the ice, and a camp of sorts had been established on a solid floe a short distance to starboard. The lifeboats had been lowered the night before. As they went over the side onto the ice, most of the men felt immense relief at being away from the doomed ship, and few, if any of them, would have returned to her voluntarily. However, a few unfortunate souls were ordered back to retrieve various items. One was Alexander Macklin, a stocky young physician who also happened to be the driver of a dog team. He had just tethered his dogs at the camp when he was told to go with Wilde to get some lumber out of the ship's forehold. The two men started out and had just reached the ship when a great shout went up from the campsite. The floe on which the tents were pitched was itself breaking up. Wilde and Macklin rushed back. The teams were harnessed, and the tents, stores, sledges, and all the gear were hurriedly moved to another floe, 100 yards farther from the ship. By the time the transfer was completed, the ship seemed on the point of going under, so the two men hurried to get aboard. They picked their way among the blocks of ice, littering the forecastle, then lifted a hatch leading down into the forepeak. The ladder had been wrenched from its supports and had fallen to one side. To get down, they had to lower themselves, hand over hand, into the darkness. They waited for a moment until their eyes grew accustomed to the gloom, and what they saw then was terrifying. The uprights were caving in, and the cross members overhead were on the verge of going. It looked as if some giant vice were being applied to the ship, and slowly tightened until she could no longer hold out against its pressure. The lumber they were after was stored in the bow of the ship. To reach it, they had to crawl through athwartship's bulkhead, and they could see that the bulkhead itself bulged outward, as if it might burst at any moment, causing the whole forecastle to collapse around them. Macklin hesitated for just a moment, and Wilde, sensing the other's fear, shouted to him above the noise to stay where he was. Then Wilde plunged through the opening and a few minutes later began passing boards out to Macklin. The two men worked with feverish speed, but even so the job seemed interminable. Macklin was sure they would never get the last board out in time, but finally Wilde's head reappeared through the opening. They hoisted the lumber up on deck, climbed out, and stood for a long moment, without speaking, savouring the exquisite feeling of safety. Later, to the privacy of his diary, Macklin confided, "I do not think I have ever had such a horrible, sickening sensation of fear as I had whilst in the hold of that breaking ship." Within an hour after the last man was off, the ice pierced her sides. Sharp spears drove through first, opening wounds that let in whole blocks and chunks of floes. Everything from midships forward was now submerged. Later, after things had settled down at the camp, a few men returned to look at the derelict that had been their ship. But not many. Most of them huddled in their tents, cold through and tired, for the time being indifferent to their fate. The general feeling of relief at being off the ship was not shared by one man, at least not in the larger sense. He was a thick-set individual with a wide face and a broad nose, and he spoke with a trace of an Irish brogue. His name was Sir Ernest Shackleton, and the 27 men he had watched so ingloriously leaving their stricken ship were the members of his Imperial Transantarctic Expedition. The date was October the 27th, 1915. The name of the ship was Endurance. The position was 69 degrees 5 minutes south, 51 degrees 30 minutes west, deep in the icy wasteland of the Antarctic's treacherous Weddell Sea, just about midway between the South Pole and the nearest known outpost of humanity, some 1,200 miles away. Few men have borne the responsibility Shackleton did at that moment. Though he certainly was aware that their situation was desperate, he could not possibly have imagined then the physical and emotional demands that ultimately would be placed upon them, the rigours they would have to endure, the sufferings to which they would be subjected. They were, for all practical purposes, alone in the frozen Antarctic seas. It had been very nearly a year since they had last been in contact with civilization. Nobody in the outside world knew they were in trouble, much less where they were. They had no radio transmitter with which to notify any would-be rescuers, and it's doubtful that any rescuers could have reached them even if they had been able to broadcast an SOS. It was 1915, and there were no helicopters, no weasels, no snowcats, no suitable planes. Thus their plight was naked and terrifying in its simplicity. If they were to get out, they had to get themselves out. Shackleton estimated the shelf ice off the Palmer Peninsula, the nearest known land, to be 182 miles west-southwest of them. But the land was inhabited by neither human beings nor animals, and offered nothing in the way of relief or rescue. The nearest known place where they might at least find food and shelter was tiny Paulet Island, less than a mile and a half in diameter, which lay 346 miles northwest across the heaving pack ice. There, in 1903, the crew of a Swedish ship had spent the winter after their vessel, the Antarctic, had been crushed by the Weddell Sea ice. the ship which finally rescued that party, deposited its stock of stores on Paulet Island for the use of any later castaways. Ironically, it was Shackleton himself who had been commissioned at the time to purchase those stores, and now, a dozen years later, it was he who needed them. Shackleton's order to abandon ship, while it signalled the beginning of the greatest of all Antarctic adventures, also sealed the fate of one of the most ambitious of all Antarctic expeditions. The goal of the Imperial Transantarctic Expedition, as its name implies, was to cross the Antarctic continent overland from west to east. Evidence of the scope of such an undertaking is the fact that after Shackleton's failure, the crossing of the continent remained untried for fully 43 years, until 1957-58, when Dr. Vivian E. Fuchs led the Commonwealth Transantarctic Expedition on the trek. And even Fuchs, though his party was equipped with heated tracked vehicles and powerful radios, and guided by reconnaissance planes and dog teams, was strongly urged to give up. It was only after a tortuous journey lasting nearly 4 months that Fuchs did in fact achieve what Shackleton set out to do in 1915. This was Shackleton's third expedition to the Antarctic. He had gone first in 1901 as a member of the National Antarctic Expedition led by Robert F. Scott, the famed British explorer, which drove to 82 degrees 15 minutes south latitude, 745 miles from the pole, the deepest penetration of the continent at that time. Then in 1907, Shackleton led the first expedition actually to declare the pole as its goal. With three companions, Shackleton struggled to within 97 miles of their destination, and then had to turn back because of a shortage of food. The return journey was a desperate race with death, but the party finally made it, and Shackleton returned to England a hero of the Empire. He was lionized wherever he went, knighted by his king, and decorated by every major country in the world. He wrote a book, and he went on a lecture tour which took him all over the world. But even before it was over, his thoughts had returned to the Antarctic. Meanwhile, an American expedition under Robert E. Peary had reached the North Pole in 1909. Then Scott, on his second expedition in late 1911 and early 1912, was raced to the South Pole by the Norwegian Roald Amundsen, and beaten by a little more than a month. It was disappointing to lose out, but that might have been only a bit of miserable luck had not Scott and his three companions died as they struggled, weak with scurvy, to return to their base. When the news of Scott's achievement and the tragic circumstances of his death reached England, the whole nation was saddened. The sense of loss was compounded by the fact that the British, whose record for exploration had been perhaps unparalleled among the nations of the earth, had to take a humiliating second best to Norway. Throughout these events, Shackleton's own plans for a transantarctic expedition had been moving rapidly ahead. In an early prospectus, designed to solicit funds for the undertaking, Shackleton played heavily on this matter of prestige, making it his primary argument for such an expedition. He wrote, "From the sentimental point of view, it is the last great polar journey that can be made. It will be a greater journey than the journey to the pole and back, and I feel it is up to the British nation to accomplish this, for we have been beaten at the conquest of the North Pole and beaten at the first conquest of the South Pole. There now remains the largest and most striking of all journeys, the crossing of the continent." Shackleton's plan was to take a ship into the Weddell Sea and land a sledging party of 6 men and 70 dogs near Vassal Bay. At more or less the same time, a second ship would put into McMurdo Sound in the Ross Sea, almost directly across the continent from the Weddell Sea base. The Ross Sea party was to set down a series of food caches, from their base almost to the pole. While this was being done, the Weddell Sea group would be sledging toward the pole, living on their own rations. From the pole, they would proceed to the vicinity of the mighty Beardmore Glacier, where they would replenish their supplies at the southernmost depot laid down by the Ross Sea party. Other caches of rations along the route would keep them supplied until they arrived at the McMurdo Sound base. Such was the plan on paper, and it was typical of Shackleton, purposeful, bold, and neat. He had not the slightest doubt that the expedition would achieve its goal. The whole undertaking was criticised in some circles as being too audacious, and perhaps it was. But if it hadn't been audacious, it wouldn't have been to Shackleton's liking. He was, above all, an explorer in the classic mould, utterly self-reliant, romantic, and just a little swashbuckling. He was now 40 years old, of medium height and thick of neck, with broad, heavy shoulders, a trifle stooped, and dark brown hair parted in the centre. He had a wide, sensuous but expressive mouth that could curl into a laugh or tighten into a thin, fixed line with equal facility. His jaw was like iron. His grey-blue eyes, like his mouth, could come alight with fun or darken into a steely and frightening gaze. His face was handsome, though it often wore a brooding expression, as if his thoughts were somewhere else, which gave him at times a kind of darkling look. He spoke softly and somewhat slowly, in an indefinite baritone, with just the recollection of a brogue from his County Kildare birth. Whatever his mood, whether it was gay and breezy or dark with rage, he had one pervading characteristic. He was purposeful. Cynics might justifiably contend that Shackleton's fundamental purpose in undertaking the expedition was simply the greater glory of Ernest Shackleton and the financial rewards that would accrue to the leader of a successful expedition of this scope. Beyond all doubt, these motives loomed large in Shackleton's mind. In fact, the abiding dream of his life, at least superficially, was to achieve a status of economic well-being that would last a lifetime. He enjoyed fancying himself as a country gentleman, divorced from the workaday world, with the leisure and wealth to do as he pleased. He was perennially entranced with new schemes, each of which in turn he was sure would win his fortune. They included an idea to manufacture cigarettes, a fleet of taxicabs, mining in Bulgaria, a whaling factory, even digging for buried treasure. Most of his ideas never got beyond the talking stage, and those that did were usually unsuccessful. Shackleton's unwillingness to succumb to the demands of everyday life, and his insatiable excitement with unrealistic ventures, left him open to the accusation of being basically immature and irresponsible. And very possibly he was by conventional standards. But the great leaders of historical record have rarely fitted any conventional mould, and it is perhaps an injustice to evaluate them in ordinary terms. There can be little doubt that Shackleton was an extraordinary leader of men. Nor did the Antarctic represent to Shackleton merely the grubby means to a financial end. In a very real sense, he needed it, something so enormous, so demanding, that it provided a touchstone for his monstrous ego and implacable drive. In ordinary situations, Shackleton's tremendous capacity for boldness and daring found almost nothing worthy of its pulling power. But in the Antarctic, here was a burden which challenged every atom of his strength. For all his blind spots and inadequacies, Shackleton merited this tribute. For scientific leadership, give me Scott. For swift and efficient travel, Amundsen. But when you are in a hopeless situation, when there seems no way out, get down on your knees and pray for Shackleton. This, then, was the man who developed the idea of crossing the Antarctic continent on foot. The largest items needed for the expedition were the ships that would carry the two parties to the Antarctic. From Sir Douglas Mawson, the famous Australian explorer, Shackleton bought the Aurora, a stoutly built ship of the type then used for sealing. The Aurora had already been on 2 Antarctic expeditions. Shackleton himself would command the Transcontinental Party, operating from the Weddell Sea side of the continent. To obtain a ship for his group, Shackleton arranged a purchase from Lars Christensen, the Norwegian whaling magnate, a ship that Christensen had ordered built to carry polar bear hunting parties to the Arctic. The final selling price of $67,000 was less than Christensen had paid to have the ship built, but he was willing to take the loss in order to further the plans of an explorer of Shackleton's stature. The ship had been named the Polaris. After the sale, Shackleton rechristened her Endurance, in keeping with the motto of his family, Fortitudine vincimus, By endurance, we conquer. As with all such private expeditions, finances for the Imperial Transantarctic Expedition were perhaps the primary headache. Shackleton spent the better part of 2 years lining up financial aid. He finally obtained some $120,000 from Sir James Caird, a wealthy Scottish jute manufacturer. And the government voted him a sum equal to about $50,000, while the Royal Geographical Society contributed a token, $5,000, to signify its general, though by no means complete, approval of the expedition. Lesser gifts were obtained from Dudley Docker and Miss Janet Stamkin-Wills, plus literally hundreds of other smaller contributions from persons all over the world. As was the custom, Shackleton also mortgaged the expedition, in a sense, by selling in advance the rights to whatever commercial properties the expedition might produce. He promised to write a book later about the trip. He sold the rights to the motion pictures and still photographs that would be taken, and he agreed to give a long lecture series on his return. In all these arrangements, there was one basic assumption: that Shackleton would survive. In contrast to the difficulties in obtaining sufficient financial backing, finding volunteers to take part in the expedition proved simple. When Shackleton announced his plans, he was deluged by more than 5,000 applications from persons, including three girls who asked to go along. Almost without exception, these volunteers were motivated solely by the spirit of adventure, for the salaries offered were little more than token payments for the services expected. Shackleton felt that the privilege of being taken along was itself almost compensation enough, especially for the scientists, for whom the undertaking offered an unmatched opportunity for research in their fields. Shackleton built the crew list around a nucleus of tested veterans. The top post as second in command went to Frank Wilde, a very small but powerfully built man whose thin, mousy hair was rapidly disappearing altogether. Wilde was a soft-spoken and easy-going individual on the surface, but he had a kind of inner toughness. He had been one of Shackleton's three companions in the race for the pole in 1908 and 9, and Shackleton had developed a tremendous respect and personal liking for him. The berth of second officer aboard the Endurance was given to Thomas Crean, a tall, plain-spoken Irishman, whose long service in the Royal Navy had taught him the ways of unquestioning discipline. Crean had served with Shackleton on Scott's 1901 expedition, and he had also been a crewman aboard the Terra Nova, which had carried Scott's ill-fated 1910 to 1913 group to the Antarctic. Because of Crean's experience and strength, Shackleton planned to have him as the driver of a sledge team in the six-man transcontinental party. Alfred Cheetham, who shipped aboard as third officer, was Crean's opposite in appearance. He was a tiny man, even shorter than Wilde, with an unassuming, pleasant disposition. Shackleton spoke of Cheetham as the veteran of the Antarctic, since he had already been on three expeditions, including one with Shackleton and one with Scott. Then there was George Marston, the expedition's 32-year-old artist. Marston, a boyish-faced, chubby man, had done outstanding work on Shackleton's 1907-9 trek. Unlike most of the others, he was a married man with children. The nucleus of veterans was completed when Thomas MacLeod, a member of the 1907-9 expedition, was signed on the Endurance as a seaman. In the matter of selecting newcomers, Shackleton's methods would appear to have been almost capricious. If he liked the look of a man, he was accepted. If he didn't, the matter was closed. Leonard Hussey, an irrepressible, peppery little individual, was signed on as meteorologist, even though he had practically no qualifications for the position. Shackleton simply thought Hussey looked funny, and the fact that he had recently returned from an expedition to the torrid Sudan appealed to Shackleton's sense of whimsy. Hussey immediately took an intensive course in meteorology and later proved to be very proficient. Dr. Alexander Macklin, one of the two surgeons, caught Shackleton's fancy by replying, when Shackleton asked him why he was wearing glasses, "Many a wise face would look foolish without spectacles." Despite the instantaneous nature of these decisions, Shackleton's intuition for selecting compatible men rarely failed. The early months of 1914 were spent acquiring the countless items of equipment, stores, and gear that would be needed. By the end of July, everything had been collected, tested, and stowed aboard the Endurance. She sailed from London's East India docks on August the 1st. But the tragic political events of these dramatic days not only eclipsed the departure of the Endurance, but even threatened the whole venture. Archduke Ferdinand of Austria had been assassinated on June the 28th, and exactly 1 month later, Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia. The powder trail was lighted. While the Endurance lay anchored at the mouth of the Thames River, Germany declared war on France. Then, on the very day that George V presented Shackleton with the Union Jack to carry on the expedition, Britain declared war on Germany. Shackleton's position could hardly have been worse. He was damned if he did, and damned if he didn't. He was just about to leave on an expedition he had dreamed about and worked toward for almost 4 years. Vast sums of money had been spent, and countless hours had gone into planning and preparation. At the same time, he felt very strongly about doing his part in the war. He spent long hours debating what to do, and he discussed the matter with several advisers, notably his principal backers. Finally, he reached a decision. He mustered the crew and explained that he wanted their approval to telegraph the Admiralty, placing the entire expedition at the disposal of the government. All hands agreed, and the wire was sent. The reply was a one-word telegram. Proceed. 2 hours later, there was a longer wire from Winston Churchill, then First Lord of the Admiralty, stating that the government desired the expedition to go on. The Endurance sailed from Plymouth 5 days later. She set a course for Buenos Aires, leaving Shackleton and Wilde behind to attend to last-minute financial arrangements. They were to follow later by faster commercial liner and meet the ship in Argentina. The trip across the Atlantic took more than 2 months. During the voyage, the Endurance was under the command of Frank Worsley, a New Zealander who had been to sea since he was 16. Worsley was now 42 years old, though he looked much younger. He was a deep-chested man of slightly less than average height, with a coarse-featured yet handsome face, which had a built-in mischievous expression. It was very difficult for Worsley to look stern, even when he wanted to. He was a sensitive, fanciful individual, and the manner in which he claimed to have joined the expedition, whether it was true or not, characterised him perfectly. As he told it, he was ashore in London staying at a hotel, when one night he had a dream in which he pictured Burlington Street, in the fashionable West End section, as being filled with blocks of ice through which he was navigating a ship. Early the next morning he hurried over to Burlington Street. As he was walking along he saw a nameplate on a door. It read, Imperial Transantarctic Expedition. Inside, he found Shackleton. The two men were immediately drawn to one another, and Worsley hardly had to mention that he wanted to join the expedition. You're engaged, Shackleton said after a brief conversation. Join your ship until I wire for you. I'll let you know all the details as soon as possible. Good morning. With that, he shook Worsley's hand, and the interview, if that is what it was, had ended. Worsley had thus been appointed captain of the Endurance. That is, he was put in charge of the physical running of the ship, under the overall command of Shackleton as leader of the entire expedition. Temperamentally, Shackleton and Worsley had some of the same characteristics. Both were energetic, imaginative, romantic men who thirsted for adventure. But while Shackleton's nature drove him always to be the leader, Worsley had no such inclinations. He was fundamentally light-hearted, given to bursts of excitement and unpredictable enthusiasms. The mantle of leadership which fell to him on the trip across the Atlantic did not rest too comfortably on his shoulders. He felt it was his duty to play the part of commander, but he was woefully out of place in the role. By the time the Endurance reached Buenos Aires on October the 9th, 1914, Worsley's lack of discipline had let morale slip to a sorry state. But Shackleton and Wilde had arrived from London, and they applied a firm hand. The cook, who had been an indifferent worker on the trip over, came aboard drunk and was immediately paid off. Amazingly, 20 men applied to fill the vacancy. The job went to a squeaky-voiced man by the name of Charles J. Green, who was a different sort of person altogether, conscientious almost to the point of being single-minded. Later, Two of the seamen, after a stormy night ashore, tangled with the outspoken first officer, Lionel Greenstreet, who had long experience in sailing ships, and were similarly let go. It was decided that the complement would be adequate with only one replacement. The berth went to William Bakewell, a 26-year-old Canadian. Meanwhile, Frank Hurley, the official photographer, had arrived from Australia. Hurley had been on Sir Douglas Mawson's last expedition to the Antarctic, and Shackleton had hired him solely on the basis of the reputation he had achieved as a result of his work there. Finally, the last official members of the expedition came on board, 69 sledge dogs that had been purchased in Canada and shipped to Buenos Aires. They were kennelled in stalls, built along the main deck amidships. The Endurance sailed from Buenos Aires at 10:30 a.m. on October the 26th, for her last port of call, the desolate island of South Georgia, off the southern tip of South America. They were on their way at last, and Shackleton was immensely relieved. The long years of preparation were over. And in the space of a few short hours, life had been reduced from a highly complex existence with a thousand petty problems to one of the barest simplicity, in which only one real task remained, the achievement of the goal. In his diary that night, Shackleton summed up his feelings. Now comes the actual work itself. The fight will be good. Among some men in the forecastle, however, there was more a mounting air of tension than of relief. The crew list carried the names of 27 men, including Shackleton. Actually, there were 28 men on board. Bakewell, the seaman who had joined the Endurance at Buenos Aires, had conspired with Walter Howe and Thomas MacLeod to smuggle his pal Perce Blackborough on board. As the Endurance rose to the increasing swell from the open ocean, Blackborough half crouched behind the oilskins in Bakewell's locker. Fortunately, there was a great deal to be done on deck, so that most of the forecastle hands were employed elsewhere, and Bakewell could periodically slip below to give Blackborough a bite of food or a drink of water. Early the next morning, the three conspirators decided their time had come. The ship was too far from land to turn back. So Blackborough was transferred to the locker assigned to Ernest Holness, a fireman who was due to come off watch shortly. Holness arrived, opened his locker, saw 2 feet protruding from under his oilskins, and hurried back to the quarterdeck. He found Wilde on watch and told him of his discovery. Wilde immediately went forward and hauled Blackborough out of the locker. He was brought before Shackleton. Few men could be more forbidding than Ernest Shackleton in a rage, and now, his huge shoulders hunched, Shackleton berated the young Welsh stowaway mercilessly. Blackborough was terrified. But then, at the height of his tirade, Shackleton paused abruptly and put his face up close to Blackborough's. He thundered, "If we run out of food and anyone has to be eaten, you will be first. Do you understand?" A smile slowly spread over Blackborough's round, boyish face, and he nodded. Shackleton turned to Worsley and suggested that he assign Blackborough to help Green in the galley. The Endurance arrived at the Grytviken whaling station on South Georgia on November the 5th, 1914. Depressing news was waiting. Ice conditions in the Weddell Sea, while never good, were the worst they had ever been in the memory of the Norwegian whaling skippers operating in the area. Several of them predicted it would be impossible to get through, and some even tried to dissuade Shackleton from trying until the following season. Shackleton decided to remain at South Georgia for a time, in the hope that the situation would improve. The whalers were especially interested in the expedition, because their first-hand knowledge of the Antarctic seas gave them a very real appreciation of the problems Shackleton faced. During the following month, Shackleton drew upon the experience of the whaling captains to form an overall picture of the movements of ice in the Weddell Sea. In the end, this is what he learned. The Weddell Sea was roughly circular in shape, hemmed in by 3 land masses. The Antarctic continent itself, the Palmer Peninsula, and the islands of the South Sandwich Group. Consequently, much of the ice that formed in the Weddell Sea was held there, prevented by the encircling land from escaping into the open ocean where it might have melted. The winds in the area were light by Antarctic standards, and not only failed to drive the ice away, but even allowed new ice to form at all seasons of the year. Finally, a strong prevailing current, moving in a clockwise direction, tended to drive the ice in an immense semicircle, packing it tightly against the arm of the Palmer Peninsula on the western side of the sea. But their destination was Vassal Bay, more or less on the opposite shore. There was thus reason to hope that the ice might be carried away from that particular stretch of coast by the prevailing winds and currents. Shackleton decided to skirt the northeast perimeter of the Weddell Sea and its evil pack, and hoped that they would find the coast in the vicinity of Vassal Bay ice-free. At 8:45 a.m. on December the 5th, 1914, the Endurance weighed anchor and proceeded slowly out of Cumberland Bay. Shackleton ordered Worsley to set an easterly course for the South Sandwich Group. The Endurance skirted the coast of South Georgia, running before a high following sea. The ship herself presented an appalling sight. 69 quarrelsome huskies were tied forward, several tons of coal were heaped on the deck midships, and up in the rigging hung a ton of whale meat for use as dog food. It dripped blood constantly, spattering the deck, and keeping the dogs in a near frenzy of anticipation, hoping a piece would fall. The first land sighted was Saunders Island in the South Sandwich Group, and at 6 p.m. on December the 7th, 1914, the Endurance passed between it and the Candlemas volcano. There, for the first time, she encountered the enemy. It was only a small patch of light stream ice, which the ship negotiated without difficulty. But 2 hours later, they came up against a band of heavy pack ice, several feet thick and a half mile wide. Clear water was visible on the other side, but it would have been extremely dangerous to push into the pack with the heavy swell that was running. So for more than 12 hours they searched along the edge of it, until at 9 o'clock the next morning they found what appeared to be a safe passage, and they started through with the engines at dead slow. Several times the Endurance smashed head-on into floes, but no damage was done. Like most of the others on board, Worsley had never seen polar pack ice before, and he was tremendously impressed by it. They passed a number of very large bergs, some of them more than a mile square, which presented a majestic sight as they rode the swell, with the seas breaking against their sides and leaping high into the air like surf, pounding against cliffs. For 2 days they sailed east, skirting the edge of the pack, before they were finally able to turn south towards Vassal Bay at midnight on December the 11th. The Endurance twisted and squirmed her way through the pack for nearly 2 weeks, but it was progress of a stop-and-go sort. Frequently she was barely able to push her way through, and sometimes she was stopped altogether and had to heave to until the ice loosened. In an open sea she could easily have covered 200 miles a day, but by midnight of December the 24th her average daily run was less than 30 miles. In spite of the disappointing progress, they celebrated Christmas festively. They had an excellent dinner of soup, herring, jugged hare, plum pudding, and sweets washed down with stout and rum. Afterward, there was a hearty song fest, with Hussey playing a one-stringed violin he had made himself. That night before he turned in, Greenstreet recorded the day's events in his diary, concluding the entry with these words: "Here endeth another Christmas day. I wonder how and under what circumstances our next one will be spent." He would have been shocked, could he have guessed. The coming of the new year of 1915 brought some changes in the pack. Sometimes they were hemmed in on all sides by dense, hummocky old floes. Yet more and more often they found only brittle young ice in their path, and they raced ahead, hardly even slowed by it. At 11:30 a.m. on January the 9th, they passed close to a berg so magnificent they gave it a name, the Rampart Berg. It towered 150 feet into the air, more than twice the height of the Endurance's mainmast. Looking down into the indigo water, they saw it stretching away beneath them, 40 feet below the keel of the ship, and going even deeper, 1,000 feet beneath them, Worsley estimated, becoming bluer and bluer until they could see it no more. And just beyond it was was the dark, rolling, ice-free ocean stretching to the horizon. They were through the pack. They set a course of south by east and ran at full speed for 100 carefree miles through open water, with whales sporting and blowing on all sides. At 5 p.m. on January the 10th, they sighted land, which Shackleton named the Caird Coast in honour of the expedition's principal backer. By midnight, they were steaming west, 500 feet off a succession of 1,000-foot ice cliffs, collectively termed the Barrier. The Endurance was now about 400 miles northeast of Vassal Bay, and Shackleton headed her in that direction. For 5 days, they ran parallel with the Barrier, and their progress was excellent. By January the 15th, they were within 200 miles of Vassal Bay. At about 8 a.m. on the 16th, heavy pack was sighted ahead. They reached it at 8:30 and saw that it was kept from moving by a number of giant bergs that were grounded on a shoal. They furled sail and proceeded under steam along the edge of the pack, looking for a way through, but none could be found. Toward noon, the wind freshened from the east-northeast, and by mid-afternoon was blowing a gale. At 8 p.m., when they saw that no real progress could be made, they took shelter under the lee of a large grounded berg. The gale continued on the 17th, and even increased in intensity. Though the sky overhead was blue, clear, dense clouds of snow driven off the land filled the air. The Endurance dodged back and forth, keeping under the sheltering protection of the berg. The gale began to moderate about 6 a.m. on January the 18th. So they set the topsail and proceeded south with the engines at slow. Most of the pack had blown away to the southwest, leaving only a small amount trapped by the stranded bergs. They made their way through it for about 10 miles until at 3 p.m. they ran into the main body of the pack once more, stretching from the face of the barrier away to the northwest as far as could be seen. But dead ahead, the dark streak of a so-called water sky held promise of a large patch of open ocean. They decided to work through the pack, and the Endurance entered it at 5 p.m. Almost immediately, they realised that this was a different sort of ice from anything encountered before. The floes were thick, but very soft, and consisted mostly of snow. They floated in a soupy sea of mushy, brash ice, composed of ground-up floes and lumps of snow. The mass of it closed in around the ship like pudding. At 7 p.m, Greenstreet headed the Endurance between two large floes toward a pool of open water. Halfway along, the ship got mired in the brash, and then another floe closed in behind her. Even with the engines at full speed ahead, it took her 2 hours to push her way through. What seemed like a routine decision was recorded in Worsley's log. We therefore lie to for a while to see if the pack opens at all when this northeast wind ceases. But it was 6 cold, cloudy days, until on January the 24th the northeasterly gale dropped off. By then, the ice was packed snugly around the Endurance in every direction, as far as the eye could see. Worsley wrote in his log, "We must possess ourselves in patience till a southerly gale occurs, or the ice opens of its own sweet will." But no southerly gale occurred, nor did the ice open of its own sweet will. At midnight on January the 24th, a crack 15 feet wide appeared about 50 yards ahead of the ship. By mid-morning, the crack was a quarter of a mile across. A full head of steam was raised, all sails set, and the engines put full speed ahead in an attempt to break through to the crack. For 3 hours, the ship leaned against the ice with all her might, and never moved a foot. The Endurance was beset. As Ord Lees, the storekeeper, put it, "Frozen like an almond in the middle of a chocolate bar." What had happened was simple enough. The northerly gale had compressed and crowded the whole Weddell Sea pack against the face of the land, and no force on earth could open up the ice again except another gale from the opposite direction. But instead of southerly gales, there were only very moderate winds. It was a chance, a freak. A hard northerly gale, then quiet cold. Among the men, the realization that the Endurance was really beset for good came very slowly, like a kind of creeping resignation, a bad dream from which there was no waking. Two or three times early in February, they tried to free the ship when cracks developed reasonably close to her, but these attempts failed completely. Then, on February the 14th, an excellent lead of water opened a quarter of a mile ahead of the ship. Steam was hurriedly raised, and all hands were ordered onto the ice with saws, chisels, picks, and any other tools that could be used to cut a lane through the floes. The Endurance lay in a pool of young ice, only about a foot or two thick. This was systematically sawed and rafted away to give the ship room to batter at the floes ahead. The crew worked throughout the day. By midnight, they'd carved out a channel about 150 yards long. Early the next morning, the men resumed the effort, working more desperately to reach the lane of water before it closed. The ship was eased astern as far as she would go, then thrown full speed ahead towards the floes. A V-shaped slot had been sawed in the ice so that the bow of the ship might split the floe more easily. Again and again she slammed into the ice, then staggered and rolled backward. Each time she bit off a little more. The crew on the ice hurriedly threw wire hawsers around each chunk, some of them weighing more than 20 tons, and the Endurance, going full speed astern, dragged them back and away in preparation for another run. But she never had a really good crack at the floes ahead. There was always too much loose ice floating around her and freezing up. It slowed her repeated onslaughts and softened all her blows. At 3 p.m., after she had smashed one-third of the way through the 600-yard ice field leading to the open water, it was decided that the expenditure of coal and effort was useless. The remaining 400 yards of ice was 12 to 18 feet thick, and Shackleton, abandoning hope of getting through, ordered the fires let down. Still, the crew refused to give up, and during their watches turned out on the ice to continue cutting away at it. But by midnight the volunteers themselves could no longer deny the hopelessness of the task, and they returned to the ship. Greenstreet summed up the general feeling in his diary that night. In a tired hand he wrote, "Anyway, if we do get jammed here for the winter, we shall have the satisfaction of knowing that we did our darndest to try and get out." Their time was running out. They noticed the approaching end of the Antarctic summer on February the 17th, when the sun, which had shone 24 hours a day for 2 months, dipped beneath the horizon for the first time at midnight. At last, on February the 24th, Shackleton admitted that the possibility of getting free could no longer be seriously considered. The sea watches were cancelled, and a system of night watchmen was instituted. Shackleton's order merely made official what long before they had all come to accept. They would have to winter on board the ship, with whatever that might bring. Word of Shackleton's decision was passed along routinely by Wilde, and if anything, it was almost welcome. The end of sea watches meant that at least the men could sleep all night. For Shackleton, however, it was another matter. He was tormented by thoughts both of what had happened and of what might happen. Hindsight now told him that if he had landed the transcontinental party on one of the places they had passed along the barrier, they would at least have been ashore, ready to strike out for the pole the next spring. But no one could have foreseen the disastrous chain of events that had brought them to their present predicament. The drift of the pack had carried them to within about 60 miles of Vassal Bay, a tantalisingly short distance it would seem. But 60 miles over hummocky ice, with God knows how many impassable tracts of open water in between, carrying at least a year's supply of rations and equipment, plus the lumber for a hut, and all this behind sledges drawn by ill-conditioned and untrained dogs. No, 60 miles could be a very long way indeed. Even had there been no obstacle to putting the transcontinental party ashore, this was hardly the time for the leader of an expedition to forsake his ship and leave others to see her through, assuming she would get through. Clearly Shackleton's duty lay aboard the Endurance. But that realization did not lessen the bitterness of the fact that the Imperial Transantarctic Expedition's chances of succeeding, while always uncertain, were now 1,000 times more problematical. He was careful, however, not to betray his disappointment to the men, and he cheerfully supervised the routine of readying the ship for the long winter's night ahead. The dogs were removed to the floes, and individual igloos, or dogloos, built for them of blocks of ice and snow. Warm winter clothing was issued to all hands, and work was begun to transfer the officers and scientists from their regular wardroom area in the deckhouse to warmer quarters in the between-deck storage area. They moved in early in March and christened their new quarters the Ritz. The conversion of the Endurance from a ship into a kind of floating shore station brought with it a marked slowdown in the tempo of life. There simply wasn't much for the men to do. The winter schedule required of them only about 3 hours' work a day, and the rest of the time they were free to do what they wanted. Their only really vital task was to lay in a large supply of meat and blubber. The meat was needed to feed both men and dogs over the winter, the blubber to be used as fuel, to make up for the over-expenditure of coal on the trip south. During February it was easy. The floes in every direction teemed with life. Sometimes they could see as many as 200 seals from the masthead, and it was simple to harvest the number needed. However, with the coming of March, when the days grew shorter, the number of animals dropped off noticeably as the seals and penguins migrated north, following the sun. Toward the end of the month, only an occasional maverick seal could be seen, and sharp eyes were needed for that. Frank Worsley, now universally called Wuzzles, had those sharp eyes. He became the chief game spotter, because his remarkable vision enabled him to pick out seals at distances of up to 3.5 miles from the crow's nest. To help him at his task, he accumulated a collection of equipment which he hung around his perch aloft, telescopes, binoculars, a megaphone, and a large flag for use in signalling the direction of the quarry, or to warn the hunting parties if there were killer whales near them. Little Frank Wild was usually the executioner. Following Worsley's directions, he walked or skied out to where the seal was lying and shot it in the head. During this period, the physical condition of the dogs caused considerable anxiety. One after another fell sick and wasted away. On April the 6th, a dog named Bristol had to be shot, bringing to 15 the total number of dogs lost since they sailed from South Georgia. Of the original 69, only 54 remained, and several of these were in a bad way. The two doctors, Macklin and McElroy, performed post-mortems on each dog and discovered that the majority of them suffered from huge red worms, often a foot or more long, in their intestines. There was nothing that could be done to cure the sick animals. One of the few items the expedition had failed to bring from England was worm powder. The loss of the 15 dogs had been partly made up, in numbers if not in pulling power, by the arrival of 2 litters of puppies. 8 of the newcomers survived, and it soon became apparent that they were as nondescript as their parents, though considerably more good-natured. The older dogs were vicious toward each other, toward their drivers, and especially toward any seals or penguins they might meet on a training run. In dealing with them, the only technique that seemed to work was a demonstration of physical superiority. On several occasions, one dog might have killed another if somebody hadn't stepped in and stopped the fight by a simple show of strength. Early in April, Shackleton decided that permanent dog drivers should be assigned with full responsibility for their teams. These posts were allotted to Macklin, Wild, McElroy, Crean, Marston and Hurley. Once the teams had been parcelled out and were training regularly, the whole crew developed a great interest in the dogs. There was keen competition each day for the positions of assistants to the sledge drivers. These training sessions were also put to the practical purpose of sledging seal carcasses back to the ship on the infrequent occasions when seals were killed. But these occasions, unfortunately, were becoming very infrequent indeed. Throughout April, the sun sank lower each day, gradually shortening the hours of light. Though the ice pack remained generally quiet, their observations showed that the entire mass was on the move as a unit. On May the 2nd, their position showed a total northwest drift since the end of February of 130 miles. The Endurance was one microcosmic speck 144 feet long and 25 feet wide, embedded in nearly 1 million square miles of ice that was slowly being rotated by the irresistible clockwise sweep of the winds and currents of the Weddell Sea. Early in May, the sun appeared over the horizon for the last time, then slowly dropped from sight, and the Antarctic night began. In all the world there is no desolation more complete than the polar night. It is a return to the Ice Age, no warmth, no life, no movement. Only those who have experienced it can fully appreciate what it means to be without the sun, day after day and week after week. Few men, unaccustomed to it, can fight off its effects altogether, and it has driven some men mad. But on board the Endurance, the coming of the polar night somehow drew the men closer together. When the Endurance sailed from England, there could hardly have been a more heterogeneous collection of individuals. They varied from Cambridge University dons to Yorkshire fishermen. But after 9 months of living and working in the same close quarters, the men had built up a backlog of shared experiences that offset the vast differences between them. During these 9 months, the men on board the Endurance had come to know one another very well indeed, and with few exceptions, they'd come to like one another too. Nobody much thought of Blackborough as a stowaway any more. The stocky, dark-haired young Welshman was a regular member of the crew now. Blackborough was an extremely quiet individual, but nonetheless quick-witted and well-liked, a cheerful, willing shipmate who helped Green in the galley. They all knew Bobby Clark, the biologist, to be a dour, hard-working, almost humourless Scot, but they knew also that he could be counted on to do his share and more whenever all hands were called to duty. He got excited only when the dredge he lowered through the ice each day fetched up a new species of creature for his collection of bottle specimens. The crew once tricked him into great excitement by placing some pieces of cooked spaghetti in one of his jars of formaldehyde. Tom Crean was a heavy-handed sailorman, forthright and tactless, who spoke with a sailorman's rough vocabulary. He was certainly not a very warm personality, but he knew the sea, and he knew his job, and the others respected him for it. When it came to Charlie Green, the cook, there was a widespread feeling that he was a little crackers or daft because of his disorganised and seemingly scatterbrained mannerisms. They called him chef or cookie, or sometimes doughballs, because of his high, squeaky voice, and because he had in fact lost a testicle in an accident. They poked fun at him on the surface, but underneath there was a fundamental respect and a fondness, too. Few men were more conscientious. While the others worked only 3 hours a day, Green was busy in the galley from early morning until long after supper at night. Hudson, the navigator, was a peculiar sort. He meant well, but he was just a little dull. He owed his nickname, Buddha, to a practical joke he'd fallen for once while the ship was at South Georgia. The men had convinced him that there was to be a costume party ashore, and any man who'd seen South Georgia with his own eyes, its glaciers and rugged mountains, the stink of whale entrails rotting in the harbour, and who could believe it to be the scene of a costume party. But Hudson did. They got him to remove most of his clothing, and they dressed him in a bedsheet. Then they tied the lid of a teapot on his head with pieces of ribbon running under his chin. Thus attired, he was rowed to shore, shivering in the icy blasts that howled down off the mountains. A party was held at the home of the whaling factory manager, but when Hudson walked in, he was most assuredly the only one in costume. In any practical joke such as this, the men knew that the one to look for was Leonard Hussey, the meteorologist. A slightly built little fellow in his early 20s, Hussey was universally liked for his unfailing good humour. They liked him, too, because he played the zither banjo and was willing to strike up a tune whenever anybody wanted to sing. A great many of the men looked on McElroy, one of the surgeons, as a man of the world. He was a handsome, aristocratic-looking individual, slightly older than most of the others, and they immensely enjoyed listening to his tales of past conquests. McElroy could be bitingly sarcastic, but the others admired him for it. It seemed to go along with his cosmopolitan nature, and there was never any malice in what he said. George Marston, the expedition's artist, was a moody fellow, up one day and down the next. He was unique among them in that he worried outwardly about the future, whereas almost everybody else was confident that everything was going to be all right. His attitude was not improved by Shackleton's obvious and increasing dislike for him. Perhaps Marston's uneasiness itself was at fault. Shackleton seemed to fear that this attitude would spread to other men. But apart from his changeable nature and the fact that he was not overly eager to turn out for work, Marston was well liked by most. Among the forecastle hands, the seamen and firemen, the only outstanding individual was John Vincent, a young, ambitious bully. He was quite short but ruggedly built, and much stronger than any of the other seamen, and he sought to use his superior strength to dominate his shipmates by intimidation. He had his eye on the vacant post of boatswain, and he felt that the best way to get it was to demonstrate a capacity for tyranny. After a time, the forecastle hands got fed up, and Howe, a soft-spoken, agreeable and extremely competent little chap, went to Shackleton and complained. Shackleton immediately sent for Vincent. Though it is not known what Shackleton told him, Vincent's attitude was considerably less domineering after that. It was remarkable that there were not more cases of friction among the men, especially after the Antarctic night set in. The gathering darkness and the unpredictable weather limited their activities to an ever-constricting area around the ship. There was very little to occupy them, and they were in closer contact with one another than ever. But instead of getting on each other's nerves, the entire party seemed to become more close-knit. Each Saturday night, before the men turned in, a ration of grog was issued to all hands, followed by the toast to our sweethearts and wives. Invariably, a chorus of voices added, "May they never meet." On Sunday evenings, the men listened to music from the hand-crank phonograph for an hour or two, as they lay in their bunks or wrote up their diaries. But the playing of the phonograph was limited because of a shortage of needles. Wilde, in sending off the requisition for 5,000 needles, failed to specify the word gramophone. Only long after the ship had sailed did Ord Lees, the storekeeper, discover they had 5,000 extra sewing needles and only a small package of the phonograph variety. Then, once each month, all hands gathered in the Ritz, and Frank Hurley, the photographer, delivered a lantern chat, a slide-illustrated lecture on the places he had visited. The Ritz, on nights like these, was a cosy place. It had been a cargo area, just below the main deck and aft of the crew's quarters in the forecastle. Then the stores and the men traded places. The area was about 35 feet long and 25 feet wide, and McNeish had erected partitions to form individual sleeping cubicles for the officers and scientists. In the centre was a long table with a paraffin-burning lamp overhead. Here they ate their meals, wrote their diaries, played cards and read. In one corner was a coal-burning stove, which kept the temperature inside quite comfortable. The Endurance's thick sides were excellent insulation. Late in May, the temperature dropped below zero and stayed there. But apart from the increasing cold, the weather remained remarkably stable and free from gales. Toward the middle of June, at the blackest part of the winter, a chance boast by Frank Hurley that he had the fastest team resulted in a dog derby. Wilde's team won, but Hurley claimed that he was carrying more weight than Wilde and demanded a rematch. He later won when Shackleton, who was riding as passenger on Wilde's sledge, slipped off going round a turn, and Wilde was disqualified. They held a special celebration on Midwinter's Day, June the 22nd. The Ritz was decked out with bunting and flags, and Hurley built a stage of sorts, which was lighted by a row of acetylene gas footlights. Everyone gathered for the festivities at 8 p.m. Shackleton, as chairman, introduced the participants. Ord Lees was dressed as a Methodist minister, the Reverend Bubbling Love, and he exhorted his listeners against the wages of sin. James, as Herr Professor von Schoppenbaum, delivered a lengthy lecture on the calorie. Macklin recited a topical verse he'd written about Captain Eno, the effervescent seafarer, who could have been no one but the effervescent Worsley. Greenstreet described the evening in his diary. "I think I laughed most over Kerr, who dressed up as a tramp and sang Spagoni the Toreador. He started several keys too high, and notwithstanding the accompanist, Hussey, who was vainly whispering, "Lower, lower," and playing in a much lower key, he kept going until he lost the tune altogether. When he came to the word Spagoni, he'd forgotten the word, so he came out with Stuberski, the Toreador, and had completely forgotten the chorus, so simply sang, "He shall die, he shall die, he shall die." It was killing, and we laughed until the tears ran down our cheeks. McElroy dressed up as a Spanish girl, and a very wicked-looking one at that, with a very low evening dress and slit skirt showing a bare leg above her stocking tops. The evening ended at midnight with a cold supper and a toast. Then everyone sang, "God Save the King." And so the winter was half done. The men's thoughts began to turn to spring, the return of the sun and warmth, when the Endurance would break out of her icy prison and they could make a new assault on Vassal Bay. Only once in the last part of June did they hear any sounds of pressure. That was on the 28th, and Worsley described it in his diary. At times during the night, a distant, rich, deep booming note is heard, changing at times to a long, creaking groan, which seems to carry a menacing tone. But then on July the 9th, the barometer began to fall. For 5 consecutive days, the reading slid downward. On the morning of July the 14th, the bottom fell out of the glass, 28.88. An ominous gloom came on about noon. The wind backed to the southwest and began to blow, though not much at first. It wasn't until 7 p.m. that the snow began to fall. By 2 o'clock the following morning, the whole ship vibrated as the wind screamed through the rigging at 70 miles an hour. Shackleton ordered that no man venture farther than the dog kennels, which were only a few feet from the ship. The men who fed the dogs had to crawl on their hands and knees to keep from being blown away. Within 2 minutes after leaving the ship, the blinding, suffocating snow blocked their eyes and mouths. On the following day, the temperature dropped to 35 degrees below zero, and the dogs were fed a half pound of lard each to help them ward off the cold. After breakfast, Shackleton ordered all hands onto the ice to try to clear the floes on the port side of snow. The area around the kennels was becoming dangerously weighted down, and he feared it might buckle under, carrying the dogs with it. All that night, the blizzard raged. But on July the 16th, the snow began to thin out, and by early morning there were patches of clear sky overhead. Before the storm, the pack had been almost one solid mass of ice, but now it was broken into pieces, and there was an area of open water to the north. It was a situation that made pressure inevitable. The ice, now that it was twisted and broken up, provided 10 million new surfaces to catch the wind, and each floe was capable of movement, independent of the rest. The pack would move with the wind, and a kind of behemothic momentum would be set up through the ice. The resulting force is called pressure, and it began on July the 21st. Not against the ship herself, for she was in the centre of a thick, tough floe. But there were sounds of ice working toward the south and southwest. The noise continued all night and into the next morning. After lunch, Worsley decided to have a look around. He put on his knitted helmet and watch coat and climbed the ladder. Almost immediately he returned with the news that their floe had cracked. Everyone dashed on deck. The crack was there, about 2 feet wide, running from the outer edge of the floe to within about 40 yards of the Endurance's port quarter. A breakup seemed imminent. They waited all that day and into the night and all the next day. No breakup occurred. The pressure could be heard all around, and occasionally they felt a heavy shock transmitted through the ice, but still the Endurance remained locked in the unbroken centre of the floe. The crack on the port quarter froze over, and as the days wore on without any significant change in their situation, the sense of expectancy diminished. On August the 1st, while the dog drivers were shovelling snow away from the kennels, there was a tremble. followed by a scraping, grinding sound, and the Endurance rose suddenly upward, then heeled to port and dropped back into the water again, rolling slightly. The flow had broken, and the ship was free. Shackleton was on deck immediately, followed by the rest of the crew. Swiftly he saw what was happening, and he shouted to get the dogs on board. All hands dropped onto the shuddering floe alongside the ship and went among the dogs, hurrying them up the gangway. The entire operation took only 8 minutes. It was just in time. As the gangway was being hoisted, the ship moved violently forward and sideways, propelled by the force of the ice driving in and under her. The stout old floe that had protected her so long became an attacker, battering her sides and churning the little dog loose to bits against her. It went on for 15 agonizing minutes, and then the Endurance's bow slowly climbed up onto a floe ahead. The men could feel her rise, and a spontaneous shout of relief went up. For the moment, she was safe.
End of Disc 1.